This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. It's our Doctor in the House series, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist. It's another Friday, George. How are you today?
It's another Friday, but a lockdown doesn't really make it feel like a Friday, right?
No, it doesn't, because you can't come into the studio and, you know, we're stuck. You know, are you at home? Are you at work?
Well, I've just finished work. Obviously, it's quiet out there. I'm, you know, thankful that many people are not going out there to do their shoppings and all sorts of things, only be out there when it's absolutely necessary. And of course, you know, looking around, we also are a little bit worried about the numbers. And hopefully everyone will be responsible, stay home, stay safe, and also stay vaccinated.
Yes, but also, you know, George, there's this worry that people who need medical attention will not come forward for fear that, you know, they may get COVID when they come to the hospital. I mean, have you seen a drastic drop in the numbers of people there?
Well, I think the sad truth is that your perception is probably true. For those people who really need treatment, if they delay the treatment, so we get to see them a little bit more complicated later on. So hopefully those people will utilize technology, telephone, WhatsApp, or whatever it is, try to get hold of your doctors and try to make sure that you stay in good health.
Okay. And I'm sure hospitals are taking precautions, right, in a big way. It's probably one of the safer places to be in, I think, because the standards of cleanliness and disinfecting and all is probably 100 times higher than even at home, right?
Indeed. All these precautions, all the SOP, as far as making sure that people are COVID negative before they're admitted, and all sorts of really stringent sanitization. However, we can never be too careful, and we can never trust anyone, because no matter how safe you think your partner, your neighbors are, there is always a small risk of transmission. So therefore, everyone needs to keep safe.
Okay. So you know what? It was World No Tobacco Day, which was on the 31st of May. You know, we always celebrate this on the 31st of May, and I always remember, because it's Gawai and Keamatan as well, isn't it, during that time, always. And so we're talking about that today. We have on the line with us Dr. Muaz Sayuti, Principal Assistant Director from the Tobacco Control Unit. He's also part of the Secretariat from the Ministry of Health of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, better known as the FCTC. It is part of the WHO, and he's on the line with us to shed more light on tobacco control. Also joining us, Dr. Roslina Abdulmanap. She's a consultant respiratory physician from Hospital Chancellor Tuanku Muriz. I remember just before we went on air, I asked Dr. Roslina, where is this hospital? And she's like, this is Hospital UKM. It's got a new name. It's had a new name for 2 years now. It's Hospital Chancellor Tuanku Muriz. Welcome to the show, both of you. How are you today?
Thank you. Thank you, Mirab.
Hi, Josh and Dr. Roslina.
Hello, George.
You know, can I just quickly start with this very important question now? We're in the thick of COVID-19, and, you know, we can come into this conversation about smokers and how, you know, smokers have to be extra cautious when it comes to COVID-19. However, in the news now, there's a lot of talk about buying a pulse oximeter. A lot of people are buying this online. It's a little device which you clip your finger, and it measures your oxygen saturation, okay? And this is because we have seen an increase in something called happy hypoxia. It just means, and this is one of the surprises of COVID-19, right? They found that what a happy hypoxia is it's people with COVID, and they have extraordinary low blood oxygen levels, but they seem fine. If you look at them, they look all right, they look comfortable, but actually the oxygen levels have dropped to very dangerous levels. Dr. Roslina, you want to tell us a little bit more about happy hypoxia?
I'll try my best, Mira. Thank you for having me on the show. So maybe if I could backtrack a little bit about why this emphasis on oxygen during this COVID pandemic. But I think listeners or your good selves may be aware about the categories of COVID being 1 to 5. And in category 3, 1 and 2 are the mild cases. 3 is in between, 4 and 5 are severe. And what distinguishes it is the progression of the disease, and category four is characterized by the need for oxygen. So therefore, you know, when a patient develops hypoxia, or which means that the blood is not carrying enough oxygen to supply the body, that means that they are in already a very severe category. So the idea of having the pulse oximeter, which, as you say, is a piece of equipment that's, you know, usually found in hospitals, quite a standard piece of equipment, is to try to detect this earlier before they become very serious and present late to the hospital. So that's kind of why the interest in pulse oximeters and hypoxia. Now, this phenomenon that you describe of happy hypoxia, it's really been quite baffling, because normally when a patient becomes hypoxemic or the oxygen levels drop, this means that there's not enough blood to the organs. And normally the patient will very, one of the early symptoms is that they start to breathe fast and they feel the short of breath. But what happens in COVID and what we sometimes see is that the patient doesn't sense this, have this sense of breathlessness, despite quite a significant drop in the saturation or the in the amount of oxygen that's in the blood. So normally it'd be above 95%. Anything below 90% is considered, you know, a warning already. It can drop quite fast. The thing is that even at very at low levels, we don't really quite understand why they do not have this sense of breathlessness. Even though they're respiratory, they might be breathing fast, but they don't sense it. One of the things that's been postulated is could be that COVID reduces this sensation, much like it reduces the sense of smell.
Right.
Anosmia has been another very novel thing that we've seen with COVID. What we've also noticed is that they also tend to have low carbon dioxide. So whether the low carbon dioxide level, because they're breathing fast actually, breathing off of the carbon dioxide, whether that also blunts the sensation of breathlessness, that may be. And so if I were to just say in a nutshell, actually, we don't know why they remain happy and hypoxic. There have been quite a few postulations. There are many reasons for them to be hypoxic, though, including the damage to the lung by the disease itself, as well as I think listeners may know, they've heard about blood clotting.
Yeah.
So the blood clots occur in very tiny vessels in the lung, and this also reduces the capacity of the lung to take in oxygen. So there you have it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
I hope I haven't been too long-winded.
No, not at all. I mean, this virus is... I've always said on the show, viruses are rascals. They're always many steps ahead of us. And to think that it is numbing sensation now is it's really quite interesting, isn't it? Losing your sense of taste and smell, and now sort of blocking that sense that you don't feel like you need, you know, you're in need of oxygen. It is many steps ahead of us, George.
Indeed, you know, so all these are new phenomenon, and then we are really catching up, trying to find out. So, Dr. Rosina, with that in mind, for those people who has got these pulse oximetry at home, what sort of things would you advise them to look out for? And for those people who hasn't got one, do you advise them to buy one?
Well, that's a bit of a tricky question. I think ideally, yes, if it's not too much of an expense, and I know you can get the models nowadays tend to be cheaper than they were, say, 5 years ago. So if you can afford it, yes. I mean, if you are a close contact, maybe not. Okay, if you are a COVID patient, I would, and you're on home monitoring, and even if you don't have comorbidities, I would advise that you get one. Because it can happen quite suddenly, and then if you didn't monitor, you might not be able to sense. So if you can, well and good. What was the other question?
For those people who already have the pulse oximetry, obviously they may not know that they have got dangerously low oxygen level. What sort of advice would you give them if they've got pulse oximetry at home?
Right. So the normal level should be above 95%. If it drops below that, I think they should contact their healthcare provider. Now, most of them would have access to either CAC, which is the COVID Assessment Center, which has triaged them either to home or to MAAPS or to a quarantine center. So there should be somebody that they should contact. I mean, failing which, if they can't get hold of their general practitioner or something, they could always call the nearest hospital. and ask for advice. So I think there should be always somebody that they can reach out to, or a family member who might be able to attend to them or to get to put them in touch with a health professional.
So the signs of happy hypoxia is purely through this pulse oximeter?
Well, there are other signs of COVID, but it's not as if that particular sign or symptom is definitely correlated with hypoxia, meaning they could have the usual symptoms. It could be different from patient to patient, and they may or may not have hypoxia. Yeah. So it's hard to predict based on a constellation of signs. There's no constellation of signs or symptoms that can predict it. And to be objective, then the pulse oximeter is the best way to measure and to be certain. I mean, the name itself, hypoxia, you have to have a definition. And in order to meet that definition, you need to measure.
What is the definition?
90 would be considered serious. I mean, anything below 90, and it would drop if 95% is normal and above, but anything below that, it could be between 90 to 95%, it could be on its way down.
Okay.
So we need to keep an eye on that. Okay. But definitely if it's 90, normally we would expect the patient to have symptoms. But what we see is that sometimes they don't.
Okay.
So, I mean, 90 is definitely dangerous already.
Sure. So those are oxygen saturation levels.
Yes.
At least 95% and more. And what that actually means is if it drops lower, your lungs cannot expel carbon dioxide efficiently. Is that what it means?
They can't take in carbon dioxide because you breathe that in, it goes to the lungs, and there are blood vessels in the lung that will take it up. And sometimes because of damage to these blood vessels or because of infection in the lung spaces, then the oxygen can't get into the blood that's in the capillaries or the very small vessels in the lungs. So the oxygen exchange, and when we say exchange, meaning oxygen comes in and it's carbon dioxide that goes out. So this is where the impairment occurs at this level.
Okay.
And then there's not enough oxygen to go around the rest of the body.
Yep. And then you are expelling carbon dioxide though.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Ooh, that sounds messy, doesn't it? Okay. All right. So pulse oximeter, if you think you need it, then perhaps. And I know you can buy it online. It's become very affordable, as you said. Dr. Muaz, so let's talk about the smokers. It was World No Tobacco Day on Monday. And according to The Lancet, the world has reached another high of 1.1 billion smokers. But do you see an increase in the number of people smoking in Malaysia, do you feel? I know it's very early to tell over the last 15 months since COVID hit. Do you think there have been more smokers or lesser?
Yeah, thank you, Mira. I think, as you said, it is, in my opinion, it is also still early to tell whether this pandemic did reduce the number of smokers or not. However, because we know that smokers is just an attributable factor that lead to the death of from COVID-19. And it is not the direct cause of the COVID-19 death itself. So it is difficult to see within this limited time the increasing or decreasing number of smokers.
Okay, and in terms of smoker habits, do you think people have stopped smoking as a result? I mean, there's a lot of fear with COVID-19, and we always talk about how smokers are at higher risk. Do you think we have people now starting to quit smoking, perhaps?
Yes, Mira, we did noted an increasing number of smokers registered under our program, our quick smoking cessation program, during this pandemic times. For example, in 2019, we have about 22,601 people registered for smoking, whereas in 2020, we have an increasing up to 28,167 smokers who registered with us.
Okay.
In the quick smoking program.
George?
Well, I'm really glad that, you know, there's a quit smoking program. I mean, Muaz, one of the things that puzzled me or worried me was that obviously the National Health and Morbidity Survey highlighted that one in two of Malaysian public are exposed to secondary smoking. And then they highlighted in categories. At home, it's about 31%. At work, it's 27%. And in eatery, it's about 10%. However, a lot of us are not going to eatery, obviously, now. And then also all the work has been shipped to home. Does that mean that more and more people are exposed to secondary smoking higher than what we were anticipating in 2019?
Yes, George. We did see the, in terms of, for example, in term, like you say, in terms of eateries, we did have less numbers of complaints in terms of eateries. However, to monitor people who smoke in their house, it is quite difficult for us to meet, to monitor that. However, the perception of the public, for example, I've met, we have a meeting, and one of the people who were in the meeting said that he's a Kelantanese lah. His father had been smoking for years, but his father is still fit. However, he the one who physically fit, and then only age about 32 years old, already have a heart attack. I just want to say to him that you are the secondary smokers, and you are the one who got the symptom first before your father.
Yeah, but that's hard to prove, isn't it? How do you prove that you've been you are the secondary smoker? How do we even know that, Dr. Roslina?
Well, the history of exposure, that is what gives the clue. And I think you can measure levels in the blood of for exposure. So that's one, but it's mainly from the history, really.
Okay, all right. But, you know, let's talk about... Yeah, sorry, George.
Well, I mean, I like more, you know, anecdotal things that people always come up with. We used to have a listener called LTY who used to constantly call in to say that he's been smoking all this while, and he's a good example that no harm has come to him. Obviously, that sort of mentality is really one of the obstacles for people to quit smoking, because they keep coming up with all these anecdotes. What do you say to people who have that sort of mentality?
Well, Josh, sometimes they say what they want to say. They say what they want to say. But however, we need to educate people who have this thinking by giving them examples, by giving them the proof that we have. For example, we need to explain to them how severe you are, how you will get the disease, even though you are the secondary smokers. And sometimes they get the disease earlier than the people who are smoking in their house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You don't realize, right? But they would be an anomaly anyway, George, don't you think? I mean, very, very few people would have been smoking and are healthy, I feel, anyway. Very, very few people.
Look at those anecdotal experience, but actually ignore 10,000 or 100,000 of other bad consequence or bad sequelae of smoking.
Yeah, and we always think of the lungs, George, when it comes to smoking. I know you have exposure to some urological conditions, which is directly or indirectly linked to smoking. George, you want to shed some light on those conditions?
Obviously, lung cancer is one of the most common, health adversity. However, a lot of people don't know that bladder cancer, which is a very common cancer, is also directly caused by the toxin in the cigarettes smoking. And for those guys out there, you treasure your sexual health. One of the most direct link of sexual dysfunction, erectile dysfunction, is directly caused by smoking. And cessation of smoking at earlier stages can reverse erectile dysfunction.
Really?
So those are really strong warnings.
It can reverse.
Absolutely. So that is one of the things that people used to think, that, you know, if you already smoke for so many years and then it's too late to quit. And therefore, a lot of study to show that a lot of the time, if you stop smoking and live healthily, a lot of things can be reversed.
Can you help us understand the science? I mean, how does the toxins affect bring about erectile dysfunction?
Well, it's all about the narrowing of the vessels. So it's not just towards the sexual organ, it's towards the whole body. So therefore, you get kidney failure, you get heart attack, you get atherosclerosis. However, if you reverse that smoking habit and actually live healthily, and then actually have less stress, and the hardening of vessels a lot of the time can stay stagnant, and then the perfusions of the organ can be improved, and therefore the health condition can be reversed.
Okay, that's fantastic. We're discussing World No Tobacco Day, which was the 31st of May, of course, in relation to COVID, in relation to other disease, non-lung diseases. You know, George, of course, very much up his alley. He sees people with erectile dysfunction and bladder cancer. I think there's a lot of interesting, very hopeful that at least erectile dysfunction can be reversed, George. I didn't realize that. So that's, we'll have more discussions up next in terms of how do we spur behavior change when it comes to smoking? What would get more people to, you know, register for the Quick Smoking Cessation Program? All of that coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's our Doctor in the House series. It's a Friday. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, co-hosting with me from home after he's been hard at work. Joining us also, Dr. Mua Sayuti, Principal Assistant Director of the Tobacco Control Unit and FCTC Secretariat from the Ministry of Health, and Dr. Roslina Abdulmanap. She's a consultant respiratory physician at Hospital Chancellor Tuanku Muhriez, better known to all of us as HUKM. We're discussing having this discussion about smoking in conjunction with World No Tobacco Day, which is on Monday, the 31st of May. You know, Dr. Roslina, you just want to go through with us very quickly, remind us why smokers are considered a high-risk group for COVID-19?
Right. Thanks, Mira. Smoking has many, many effects. I think for the sake of brevity, I'll just concentrate on the lung. And one of the things that smoking does to the lung is it lowers the defenses. Now, many people may not know that the lung itself has got innate defenses. It's got these little hair-like structures called cilia. And this is one of the first lines of defense in the lung. And it's the reason why you can cough up your spit, your sputum, because these little wavy little structures will push your phlegm and your mucus up. Right, so that it gets to your throat and it's in your lung, you can cough it up, then you clear your lungs. However, if you smoke, the cilia will not be able to wave, they will not be able to function. It's known as a ciliary escalator. So when they move in tandem, the mucus gets moved up. So if you had a virus or a bacteria, it'd be trapped in the mucus and the cilia would move it along, and your other cells, like your macrophages, cells that would eat bugs, would come and attack it. But all these are impaired when you smoke. Your cilia, your clearance of your mucus, your immune cells, they're just not as efficient at clearing foreign bodies, including viruses and bacteria. So that's one of the reasons why if they get infected, they're more prone to severe disease. So that's just talking about the first line of defense. If they have been smoking for a long time, they do get structural lung damage. So the classic example would be chronic obstructive airway disease and emphysema. And they actually lose the little structures where the oxygen exchange occurs, the alveoli. This is what we spoke about earlier. Mm-hmm. So these sort of get destroyed, and they just don't have the surface area to absorb the oxygen. So they can become very hypoxic quickly. And not only that, if they have underlying structural lung disease, if they become bad, they become difficult to ventilate. I mean, everybody's heard about ventilators. Yeah. These are when you have a tube put down and the machine supports your breathing. So if you've got lung damage, your lungs become more stiff. And the volumes are not normal, and so it becomes difficult to set the ventilator correctly, and gaseous exchange doesn't occur. So I'm sorry, I could go on and on about this.
That's okay. But
essentially, yes, they damage their defenses, they damage the structure, they are difficult to manage, and they're slow to respond, and therefore they tend to get more severe disease.
Let's talk about the ventilator. I mean, all of us, you know, we get reports every day of how many people are on ventilators. What is a ventilator actually doing?
Okay, earlier we spoke about the one of the main functions of the lung is to take in oxygen, deliver it to the blood, and the blood, as it comes to the lung, it brings carbon dioxide, and that leaves the body, right? So inhalation, it's oxygen from room air, and exhalation, it's carbon dioxide, which is the byproduct of the body's metabolism. So that's what a normal lung would do. So when you breathe in and you breathe out, gaseous exchange occurs. And that can't happen in COVID because either there's not enough blood supply because of damage to the blood cells, to the lining of the blood vessels, or they might be blood clots, or they might be the damage caused by the infection itself, the cytokines and so on. So there's lung damage, so it's just not able to absorb the oxygen and exchange. So the ventilators do the work of breathing, essentially, for the patient. They will help to move the chest wall, and expand the lungs so that oxygen can come in and carbon dioxide can come out.
It helps to facilitate that exchange.
Yes, it does. And maybe I would say more than facilitate, because in some cases, in severe cases, the patient is totally dependent on that.
Okay.
You know, it's not just like assisting, but patients could become ventilator dependent, and then we have difficulty getting them off the ventilator and so on. So,
okay. Currently we know that the severity of COVID-19 among smokers, is worse. About the ability to recover? Will that be hindered if you have been a smoker?
Right. Yeah. So I've mentioned about the thing about smoking is that you damage your lungs. So you're already starting off from a lower lung capacity and a lower lung reserve. So if anything hits your lung, like a bad COVID infection, you have less reserve. So that's why it makes it more difficult for us to treat them. And therefore, the recovery process itself is more difficult and longer. In terms of the ventilation, in terms of the response to treatment. So in many, many ways, it affects the lung, both the risk of getting infection, the ability to defend the lung, the ability to clear the infection, to have gas exchange, and to recover. Right. So at all stages, Mira, sorry to say, So smoking is bad news if you get COVID.
Okay.
COVID is bad news if you're a smoker, yeah.
Yes.
Don't smoke.
Don't smoke. No, we've said it a million times, but we'll come back to that discussion. But are we seeing more? We seem to have seen more vapors, Dr. Moaz, even before the pandemic. A lot of younger people seem to be vaping. Is that still the case?
Yes, Mira. We see a number of vapors. Actually, the vape came to Malaysia is in 2015, and from there we can see many young people, many more exposed. They are exposed to the vape, and then we can see mushroom of vape stores, either physical or online stores. And within this COVID-19 situation, within the pandemic and MCOs. These stores, the e-commerce have become one of the platform for the people who sell the vape.
Okay, so they moved from physical stores to online.
Yes.
So it is still a big problem for us. And I'm sorry, George, you were going to say?
Yeah, Dr. Moore, I mean, obviously, thing is a very different world in 2019 and now. Again, coming back to the national health and mobility survey, it highlighted that 21% of Malaysian populations are smoker, and then also 5% are e-smoker. What do you think, the taking into considerations of the lockdown, the stress and everything, do you think the number has gone up for the smokers, like physical smoker, and also the e-cigarettes, compared 21% and 5% in 2019?
Sorry, Jeff, for the we don't have the data for during these pandemics to see.
You've got feelings, judging from what is in the ground. And then do you think the physical smokers, because of the stress and lockdown and everything, do you think it goes up, or more and more people come to see you for quitting? And also, or do you think that they're shifting to e-cigarette?
Yes, Josh. Definitely we can see, we can compare this with the numbers of the e-cigarette shop that is mushroom, become mushroom in our community.
Yeah.
Because when there is a demand, and then, of course, we know that many people are using the e-cigarettes or vapes. Even though the advancement of vapes, they have become few generation of this device. We know from vape, they become mod and then become smaller and smaller and become pods. And that what attract the youngsters to use vapes, actually. Yeah.
And Dr. Roslina, does it make a difference, though, for people who are vaping? And then there's a heat not burn, heat no burn type of smoking as well. Does that really make a difference? Because with those two, it's pretty much nicotine. It's still existing there. Does that still affect the lung as badly as normal smokers? I mean, people who smoke the traditional cigarette?
Yeah, the vape fumes also contain other toxins, right? So even if it's not nicotine, there are other chemicals that are potentially damaging to the functions of the lung. So even though it's not, it might not be nicotine itself. Is that your question?
Yep, George.
Do you think, you know, people argue that the e-cigarette is lesser of the two? What is your argument when people tend to shift towards e-cigarettes on that basis, or even use e-cigarette as a modality to quit smoking?
You see, you thought I was going to ask you the tough questions. Yeah, now you answer, George.
Again, that is a tough question because, you know, there are always these anecdotes of people who've been able to reduce their smoking or even to quit and then switch to vape itself. So I would say the jury is still out on this. I know there are very strong opinions on both sides of the camp. Myself, I think there may be a role for you know, but it's yet to be defined. And even so, if it was going to be used as a modality to quit smoking, it still have to be under supervision. And it would only be as an intermediary step, you know, to absolutely stop smoking and vaping. It shouldn't be a replacement for smoking.
Yeah, Dr. Moaz.
So, yeah.
I think we should go back into the history of smoking itself. You know, when the first smoking was introduced, the cigarette was introduced, the company claimed that this is a health product.
Yeah.
This is healthy for you. You will not get side effect. If you get the side effect, then tomorrow immediately we will take our product. We won't sell anymore. Yeah. But after how many years? After 30 years, then after 30 years only we can conclude that the smoking have the effect to the lung, and especially to the lung cancer. And for the e-cigarette itself, for vape, we already seen, doesn't have to wait for 30 years. We already seen the result. For example, the cases of Ivali, where the e-cigarette caused a dysfunction, irritate the lung. And then, of course, we doesn't have to wait for 30 years to see the effect of the e-cigarettes. So all this advertisement that is one of method of smoking cessation, I think this is a scam from these people who want to sell vape.
Okay. You know, and people who are smoking and vaping, will that increase the transmission of COVID-19 to others through smoke particles, perhaps? Do we know?
Well, it's been postulated. I mean, apart from the vapor and the airborne particles, that people who smoke and vape tend to touch their nose and their mouth more. So if their hands, if they've touched a contaminated surface, they would be more at risk because of the act of smoking and vaping itself. And also things like shisha or hookah, they would be sharing the mouthpiece. So that's another possible mode of transmission. So this is the thinking that actually they have more risk of infection from the behavior itself.
Okay, you want to just elaborate a little bit on Ivali that Dr. Moaz was talking about, Dr. Roslina?
Oh, yeah, this is an acute lung injury, and it was particularly in the early days, it was seen in the young people, even young teenagers. And it's a very extreme form of lung damage that occurs over a short space of time. And it used to be seen in other, I mean, it's a descriptive pattern actually of injury. And when we look at the lung samples, what was seen was that this injury was similar to what was seen in certain other severe conditions, such as severe infections or severe toxins to the lung. And this one is related to vaping itself and to the chemicals that are in the vape itself. So it's now very well established. At first, it wasn't very certain. And I think the evidence for it has come out over the last 3 years or so. So it's very definitely related to vaping. And it's severe and it can last. And even if they survive, I mean, there's a certain mortality rate associated with it. But if they survive, the lung may be permanently damaged and scarred. So it's nothing to be taken lightly. And the thing is, we can't predict who's going to get it.
Yeah, I see.
And,
okay.
And yeah, it's not. It can happen to any vapor.
Okay, Dr. Yeah. Moaz.
I mean, what worried me is that in these few weeks we can see a few celebrities promoting vape, and then as if the vape is one of the smoking they promote is as if this product is one of the smoking cessation program.
Yeah.
They even have the 7 days challenge. They claim after 7 days you will stop smoking, but the fact is, people who vape, eventually they will become a dual smoker, or instead of they will, and then instead of giving up the vape, initially they will become a prolonged user of the vape.
Right.
That is the fact that sometimes that very worried.
Yeah, so I think what is more worrying is that with COVID around and we have younger people vaping, what does that actually mean for them, right? It's a scary thought. Let's look at changing behavior. Do you think we will be able to change behavior when it comes to smoking at all, Dr. Roslina? I mean, would you think a blanket ban for smoking works?
Yeah, behavioral change, I think, is the most challenging aspect of disease management.
Yeah.
Be it diabetes, be it smoking, be it, you know, I mean, you can see even in the pandemic, you have the best of SOPs, but again, it's human behavior that determines whether the SOPs are going to work or not. So I think that's historically some of the most effective things have actually been where it hits the pocket. So things like, increasing the price of cigarettes, that's been shown to reduce consumption. Then the educational campaigns and all that, yes, I think, but perhaps more limited. I think the economic factor is the one that makes a difference in terms of reducing the numbers of smokers. No, maybe Dr. Moaz has other views.
But then they talk about the black market and people go and get it there, yeah?
Dr. So Moaz, that's the argument, yeah.
Dr. Moaz, the theme for this year's World No Tobacco Day is commit to quit. What would you say to smokers to encourage them to quit?
What I would say that this is the time. This is the time for you to quit smoking. Out of what we have seen, out of how many deaths that we have seen in these few weeks, it's very horrifying. We had hundreds deaths in a day. For now, we don't have the numbers yet, how many smokers among the death. But I believe this condition will, if more people smoking, this will make the things worse.
George?
Dr. Moore, obviously, people were quite taken back by what you just said. If the listeners out there are convinced and try to come to see you to get help, to get smoking cessation, can you talk through the listeners out there, what sort of process will they go through and what is the sort of success rate are you quoting them?
Okay, Josh. We know that during this pandemic, the issues is about the accessibilities. And then for people to get the smoking cessation, go to the smoking cessation program. We at the Ministry of Health, we have worked with 13 other NGOs and companies to create a better platform for people to quit smoking by just visiting our website at jomquit.com. Then they can subscribe to the quit smoking program.
Have you moved it online though?
Yes, we are moving online. And then they can subscribe to any providers, quit smoking providers that are near to their homes. And of course, this is we have launched it in in 2020, and then we have improved the platform in 2021. And then what is the jomquit.com? It's a platform where people can get the smoking cessation program from the providers that are near to their home, just from their fingertips and just online. So then they can have smoking consultation online, or even can the medicine can itself can be sent to their home.
Oh, I see. Okay, all right. So it involves some amount of drugs as well to help you quit smoking.
Yes, of course, because Mira, we know that nicotine is very addictive, and the addiction of nicotine is more than even like what we call marijuana or other addiction products.
Right.
So to quit is not easy. So most of them, sometimes they try to quit, but they fail to quit because they doesn't come for help. So what I advise for the listeners out there, come and get help from jomquit.com. We will try to help you because to quit is very hard. So we can provide you with consultation. We can provide you with help, either using the nicotine replacement therapy or using other drug which is not nicotine based.
Okay, fair enough. So yeah, so it can be done. I think if you think of it as a disease, I don't know whether I'm being very drastic. If you think of addiction as a disease, it's a medical condition, then it's a lot easier to get help rather than to think that you've been a failure and that it's a weakness. And that sort of changes your perception of why you should be quitting smoking.
And just to update a little bit, Mira, sorry, what Josh have asked, our quit smoking cessation program, the quit smoking rate is about 50%. So I think this is a good numbers, even better than what is being targeted by the WHO. Which is
fantastic.
Which is,
and for how long 50%. Do you consider success?
The success rate, we consider when the people don't smoke for 6 months.
Okay, all right.
At least 6 months.
Sure. Okay. Would you have a message for us, Dr. Roslina, for World No Tobacco Day?
Yes, I would like to say that if at all, don't ever start smoking. But if you do happen to be a smoker and you wish to quit, assistance is out there. We wish you all the best in your attempts to quit smoking.
George?
Well, actually, Mira, how many shows have we done for the last 12 years on these?
Every year, at least one laugh for World No Tobacco Day.
One, you know, kudos to your station that today, obviously celebrating tomorrow's the World Environmental Day.
Yeah.
And then obviously smoking itself will have tremendous impact, not just to the health, to the environment and all sorts of things. I like to quote what they say is that for the whole things about sustainability and protecting the environment, this is the time during the lockdown and pandemic. It's good to reimagine, recreate and restore. I really think that we constantly every year need to reimagine how to stop smoking and recreate these ways, pathways for the sufferers and restore their health. And I really think that's crucially important.
Okay, so if you'd like more information or you're thinking of quitting, you can head to jomquit.moh.gov.my for information.
Mira, yes. Jomquit.com.
Okay. Sorry about that. That's a new one. So jomquit.com. That's easy.
Yes.
Fantastic. For more information and how you can start, and it's, you know, taken, they've taken it closer to you. So give it a shot, lah. You know, you never know, right? I mean, after what Dr. Roslina has spoken about COVID and what, you know, what is that, swelly things that you were talking about in the lungs?
Celery.
Yes, thank you. I can just imagine them just getting hard, you know, and not functioning at all. Thank you all very much for joining us today. That was very enlightening. Dr. Muaz Sayuti, Principal Assistant Director of Tobacco Control Unit and FCTC Secretariat, Ministry of Health, and Dr. Roslina Abdulmanap, Consultant Respiratory Physician, Hospital Chancellor, Tuanku Muhriz, and of course, Dr. George Lee. Have a good weekend, George. Consultant Urologist on Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.